From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll explore how Latinos have integrated into Wisconsin communities, the impact of cultural exchange, and perceptions of immigrants. Then, we'll speak with All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro about his work at NPR and his favorite kinds of stories to work on.
No matter where you are in history, where you are in the world, where you are in the spectrum of wealth, class, any variable, does not matter, food is there.
Plus, we'll learn about bird banding alongside young aspiring scientists.
Birds are such a fun and accessible way for kids to learn about the natural world.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Although Latino people have lived in Wisconsin nearly as long as it's been a state, historian Sergio Gonzalez says Latino communities are often seen as being perpetual outsiders. Gonzalez is the author of Mexicans in Wisconsin and Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. His work explores how Latinos have integrated into Wisconsin communities, the impact of cultural exchange, and perceptions of immigrants. He joins us to talk about the history of Latino immigration in Wisconsin and what it looks like today. I think there's this misperception that Latino immigration is a relatively new phenomenon in rural Wisconsin especially, but as your work has found, that's not the case. When do we first start to see large groups of Latino immigrants coming to rural Wisconsin?
Yeah, so, you know, we know that Latinos have been in the state of Wisconsin since the late 19th century, but Latinos have been moving beyond urban spaces since the first decades of the 20th century. And, you know, they went out looking for the same opportunities that European immigrants had been looking for before them. And that was better economic opportunity in farming. And so when a lot of agricultural industries began to turn to migrant labor to supplement, basically to kind of have that larger labor source to really ramp up the efforts, 1920s, 1930s, especially after World War II, we started to see large communities of Latinos moving into these spaces. So whether it was Texas Mexicans who are American citizens migrating up here, but also Mexican nationals who were brought in as part of the Bracero program in the 1940s. Puerto Rican migrant workers, American citizens brought in to work as well, Jamaicans, people from Belize, from the Bahamas, all in the 1940s and 1950s, going to all parts of rural Wisconsin.
You mentioned something interesting inside of that, the Bracero Project. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. In 1942, the United States, of course, is ramping up the wartime effort. Young men are going overseas to serve in the armed forces. People are moving out of rural spaces to find really good jobs and industrial labor in cities. And so farmers need labor to continue this work, specifically to feed men overseas. And so what does the U.S. government do? It signs an agreement with the Mexican government to basically ship Mexican nationals into the United States. So when I say ship, I mean that explicitly because they were coming over as imported workers. They would sign these limited-term contracts where they would go and work in industries all across the country, in railroads, but specifically in farming. And so Wisconsin, which of course depended on workers to do things like the cherry industry, the cucumber industry, sugar beets, you name it, needed workers to fill those roles. And they found them in places like Mexico, and they found them in the Caribbean as well, black migrants who would arrive here to work all across the state.
Yeah. Now, a movement to deport people is really what happens after that. People who had come to help farming and other production throughout the country, it really kicks off in the 1950s, and it becomes the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, these things are intimately connected. You know, the Bracero program in the 1940s makes very clear that there are economic opportunities in the United States and there's employment opportunities here. Unfortunately, that program for those Mexican nationals back in Mexico are pretty limited because they're limited term contracts and there's only a certain amount of spots that are available. But that doesn't mean there's only a certain amount of jobs available in the United States. And so at the same time that the United States opens up this guest worker program in 1942, we also saw the beginning of a rise of undocumented immigration from Mexico into the United States. And so you have workers coming over who perhaps had not been able to apply for the Bracero program, but they still need to provide for themselves and for their families. They cross the border surreptitiously without legal documentation, and they go wherever someone will offer them a job, including here in Wisconsin, across the Midwest, all across America. And so with this growing undocumented population, some Americans, of course, become very alarmed that there are these people who are existing in this country who don't have citizenship, who don't have a formal relationship with the state. In the early 1950s, amidst economic recessions, the federal government decides to initiate a very vast deportation scheme. President Eisenhower calls it Operation Wetback. And its intention is basically to round up all of these people who have coming to this nation, have been recruited into the country to do this work. It destabilizes communities, it destabilizes economies, and it's pretty disruptive. Unfortunately, what it also sets is a pattern that future presidential administrations follow. Whenever there's an economic recession, they will turn to similar tactics to round up these people who are now seen as surplus labor and send them back to their home countries.
Looking at this idea of the country being full, especially, I think if you go to a lot of small towns in Wisconsin, you might not think that's the case. There are so many small towns throughout the state of Wisconsin that are really losing population, losing people. And in fact, Latina immigration has helped a number of communities. So looking at that whole picture, right now, how would you describe the relationship between Latinos and the overall communities in rural Wisconsin towns?
I mean, I would say it's complicated, Joy. I mean, I think you're pointing to a very real fact, which is if you look at the material circumstances of some parts of our state, it's very clear that there has been demographic decline and that the prospects of these spaces, if we look in the next 10 years, much less the next 50 years, are pretty dim, right? If we just think about, like, what will the replacement of communities actually look like? In many of these spots, Latino migration, in-migration into these locations represents the only form of vitality in terms of kind of reviving some of these spaces. And we can look at that in different spaces. We could talk about economically in terms of the labor market. We could look at schools and kind of the growth and the regrowth of elementary schools and kindergarten programs that perhaps had declining population over the last few decades. We can talk about that in cultural spaces and social spaces and the way in which Latinos kind of revive some of these spaces as well with their own traditions and their own customs. That, however, if we talk about the material, it's very different from the way people feel things. And it's hard to separate the fact that perhaps many rural Wisconsinites have this sentiment that they've been left behind, that they've been abandoned, that they don't have the resources they think they need. And it's hard to disentangle whether or not that's true or not. It's the way in which people feel. And that manifests in many different ways. Sometimes people can find a sense of solidarity with newcomers and say, we have similar circumstances here. Perhaps we can find a way to bind ourselves as a community. But unfortunately, oftentimes what that actually means is that the newcomer is seen as someone who's invading a space and someone who's there to take the remaining last bits of resources, as opposed to seeing that person as someone who brings opportunity, someone who brings a new future for that location.
Yeah. It's interesting just how many communities really celebrate their immigrant past in small towns in Wisconsin and then do seem to have a reluctance, let's say, to accept new people into these communities. What would you say are some of the overall misunderstandings about Latinos in rural Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think you're keying on one of the things that has always bedeviled me as a lifelong Wisconsinite, but as also someone who is the son of Latino immigrants, Mexican immigrants to the state, that Wisconsin is very proud of certain aspects of its immigrant past. And we see that reflected in kind of the cultural sites that we celebrate, whether it's a place like Old World Wisconsin or, you know, our beer culture, which is very solidly based in our German or Swiss past, or cheese. I mean, all of these different things, bratwurst, right? All these things that kind of make Wisconsin what it is. We can say this very clearly. Wisconsin, it's proud of its immigrant history. And yet, when we talk about its immigrant present and its immigrant future, we sometimes draw lines about what is authentically Wisconsin. And so we talk about Latino immigrants as being newcomers, as being exotic, as being strangers in communities, as opposed to thinking of them as being another chapter in Wisconsin's long history of immigrant belonging and immigrant making into this space. And so, you know, one of the things I would hope people continue to wrestle with as we look at a place like Arcadia, Wisconsin, that has been absolutely transformed. And Arcadia is kind of the space that people often refer to, but it is a perfect case study. And it's one that I think is going to be replicated in other parts of Wisconsin over the next few decades. is how do Latino immigrants arrive within a longer history of remaking spaces as part of an immigrant tradition? But what new things are they introducing into this space as well, right? So that Latinos don't have to be shoehorned into this idea of what it means to be a Wisconsinite, what it means to belong, what are the things you need to throw off about yourself in order to fit into this space. Because, you know, when we think about hospitality, this kind of guest and host relationship, we need to begin to trouble that and to understand that Latinos are not guests in Wisconsin. They have been here for over 100 years. And if people are being honest with themselves, they're going to be here for another 100 more.
Now, we are in a very specific moment in our history, both as a state and a nation. Former President Donald Trump, he is proposing the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. What are the realities of what that would mean for Wisconsin communities?
I don't think anybody can actually wrap their head around what this would materially, physically mean. Because, you know, first of all, there is the outright lie that he mentions that there are, you know, 20 million undocumented people in this country, which is, you know, nearly double of the number that are actually living in this country, that have been living here for decades. But if we wrap around our heads, you know, in a four-year term that he would be responsible for detaining and deporting 11 million people in the United States. I don't think anybody can actually imagine what that would look like physically, but also the allocation of resources this would entail. What would it mean to communities to have to reallocate policing and law enforcement resources to do this type of work? Much less the reality of what this would mean for economies all across the state. And I don't think listeners would be surprised to know, of course, that the first place I think of is our dairy industry. Wisconsin, of course, is the number two dairy producer in the United States, number one in our hearts, of course, but number two in terms of production. And that's an industry that is heavily dependent on immigrant labor, right? The majority of workers who work in the dairy industry today are immigrant, and the majority of those workers are undocumented. Now, we have wrestled with this question numerous times over the last decade here in Wisconsin because our state legislature and local common councils have tried to pass legislation that would force local law enforcement to act as an auxiliary arm of immigration and customs enforcement. These are often known as like 287G agreements, secure communities agreements. You know, our state legislature in 2016 tried to pass a similar law for the entire state, and they didn't get passed. Why did that law not get passed in 2016? Because dairy farmers picked up the phone and called their legislators and called the governor and reminded them that were these laws to pass, these industries would be devastated. And so it's sometimes hard to wrap our heads around the way in which people might vote based on rhetoric, based on vibes, based on perhaps some mythic idea of what they want the country to be and what the material reality would be for them, their families, the industry that makes this state America's Dairyland.
Well, we will see what the future holds. Sergio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, John. Con el programa Bracero,
la esclavitud moderniza. Sergio González is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of the books Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin, and Mexicans in Wisconsin. We spoke as part of an immigration special in October of this year. Para ayudar a los güeros a forjar su capital. Millones llegarán antes, millones irán. Ari Shapiro has been one of the hosts of NPR's All Things Considered since 2015. Before that, he was also NPR's Justice, White House, and international correspondent. Outside of his work on air, Shapiro also wrote a memoir and sings in a cabaret show with Tony Award winner Alan Cumming. Shapiro came to Milwaukee this fall ahead of the presidential election to talk to people in our swing state. That's when he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about journalism and his interests outside of work.
This project is something that you're doing outside of your hosting role that many listeners might know you primarily for. So can you share some behind-the-scenes insights of being an All Things Considered host? And from the interviews you get to do, the debriefs, do you get to pick and choose what you get? And when are you given opportunities like this to do projects outside of the host chair?
Yeah, it's a mix. So we have four weekday hosts of All Things Considered. In addition to myself, there's Juana Summers, Mary Louise Kelly, and Elsa Chang, who's based at NPR West. And then, of course, Scott Detrow is the host on the weekends. And the nice thing about that is because two of us host the radio show each week, generally in a given month, I will be hosting the radio show for 2 weeks. I'll be hosting the podcast, Consider This, for 1 week. And I'll have an assignment week for like 1 week a month, which is what this is for me. So I am spending this week not hosting the radio show or the podcast, but I'm on assignment, reporting in Wisconsin, doing stories that will air on the radio show and the podcast. On a day that I am hosting the radio show, we have an editorial meeting at 9:30 each morning where everybody on staff sits around the table, from the most junior people to the executive producer. And we look at what's already on the board for that day. So we might see, oh, our White House correspondent is bringing us a story about whatever the president is doing. We have a story from Israel about the war in Gaza, et cetera. And then we go around the table and talk about what else we think should be on the show. And that helps shape the program every day. We also look at the board and think, how much domestic news is there? How much foreign news is there? Where is the joy, the surprise, the uplift? What's the balance of longer pieces to shorter pieces? How do we mix it up to make sure we don't only have politics and war, but also arts, sports, business, science, and all the other things that make it all things considered?
Absolutely. So before I ask about more of the things you've done at NPR, I'm going to throw it way back. What did you do before NPR, and what inspired you to get into radio?
Well, before NPR, I was in college. I got an internship right after I finished my undergrad degree and have really never left NPR. But I grew up as a backseat listener. It was on in my house.
Yeah.
It, like driving around in the car as a kid, it was always on. I used to joke that the All Things Considered theme music gave me a Pavlovian reaction because my mother was always cooking dinner when All Things Considered came on. So, like, I associated ATC's theme with eating. And now I hear it every day, you know, every hour, which is a problem when you have to actually be on the radio and not salivating. But I've always loved the storytelling aspect of it. I love pursuing my curiosity. I love that every day I wake up knowing that I will learn about something over the course of the day that I didn't know about, that I get to ask people who are doing the most important work in their field, whatever that field might be, questions that might be totally basic and ignorant, and I just get to learn what they know, and that's a fringe benefit of my job. I just feel very lucky to get to do that.
I know. I can genuinely tell people when they ask about the job, it's like, I really do learn something new every day.
Completely.
Could be minor fact, could be a random thing I'll never use, or it could be a big consequential
thing. Totally. I'm learning so much about Wisconsin right now.
Yeah. And growing up on NPR, you know, when you were thinking about like, oh, is this a career path I could take? Was there a particular story or journalist that stood out to you that kind of planted that first seed of possibility?
Well, my internship was with Nina Totenberg, who is such a legend. She has been NPR's legal affairs correspondent since many, many years. She started at NPR in the 1970s. And among the many things that I appreciated about Nina is that she got her start in journalism at a time that there was not an obvious place for people like her in journalism. Women were not hired to do hard news. And NPR in its early days hired people like the late Cokie Roberts, like Linda Wertheimer, like, you know, people like Mara Liasson found a home for the kind of hard news reporting that they wanted to do when the main networks were not hiring women to do hard news. And so I look up to those people because they sort of shaped the journalism field to make space for themselves in a way that I think I and others who have come after me have also continued to do. And journalism is not static. Journalism evolves, and we can help shape it through the work that we do.
As you mentioned, your first internship was with Nina, who, according to your book, was a celebrity on par with Meryl Streep in your household growing
up. Yes, it's true. When Nina called my house to talk to me and my mother picked up the phone.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, she recognized the voice immediately.
Yeah.
Sort of freaked out a little bit. Absolutely. Yeah, Nina was a big celeb. Getting to work with her, getting to talk to her, getting to this day to be friends with her and consider her a mentor is just a wild privilege.
Did you click right away? What were you feeling that first day?
It was such an overwhelming time because I had never been to Washington, D.C. before. And this was the beginning of 2001, January 2001. The Clinton administration was ending. The Bush administration was coming in. Nina would take me as her plus one to all of these events, celebrating the outgoing cabinet member from the Bush administration or the incoming official from the Clinton administration. So I was going with her to the Kennedy Center and the Supreme Court, to all these fancy events. Being this kid just out of college who had never met a senator or a Supreme Court justice, it was overwhelming, but it was also just kind of a Cinderella experience.
After your internship with Nina, you did a production job for Morning Edition from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m., I assume drinking coffee for 8 hours straight.
That was when I started my daily coffee addiction.
There you go.
I have coffee in front of me right now, as a matter of fact.
Courtesy of Colectivo, one of the best ones here. And with this production job for Morning Edition, you also started doing reporting on the side as a freelancer, and you did a lot of food stories. And I love a food story. So what's your favorite thing about reporting on all the people and the things, ingredients, everything that revolves around food?
Here's the thing about food. No matter where you are in history, where you are in the world, where you are in the spectrum of wealth, class, any variable, does not matter, food is there. And so by looking at the world through the lens of food, you can tell stories about things that might feel distant and unrelatable that become more accessible because everybody can relate to and enjoy and share food. So telling a story about whether it's MREs, meals ready to eat on the battlefield in a war zone, or a black tie steak dinner for a visiting world leader at the White House, offer ways of telling stories through the lens of food that might otherwise make people's eyes glaze over.
You've covered a wide range of topics, you know, included in a wide, wide spectrum. You've had different titles at NPR, such as Justice Correspondent, there's White House Correspondent, International Correspondent, where you're based in London. Mm-hmm. Throughout all these roles, what was your guiding principle that centers your reporting, no matter the topic or beat you're on?
Whatever I'm reporting on, I want to be surprised. I want somebody to say something that I didn't expect. If I go out to report a story and I come back with exactly what I thought I would find, then I've done something wrong. I'll give you an example. I did a story several months ago on a wind farm coming to a coal town in West Virginia. And the story that I set out to tell was about coal workers finding clean energy jobs as the coal economy tanks. Well, I learned that I was completely wrong about two things. The first thing is that coal jobs in West Virginia and in the United States generally had tanked a long time ago. First, when automation came to the coal industry many decades ago in the 20th century, and then when fracking lowered the price of coal in the 21st century. So by the time wind came on the scene, coal jobs were already a tiny fraction of what they once were. That was the first thing that I realized I was wrong about. The second thing I realized I was wrong about is that wind turbines require far less human labor than coal mines do. And so the idea that people would go from working in the coal mines to working on the wind farm was just wrong, because a small handful of people were needed to work on the wind farm. There were some who used to work in coal, but the vast majority of people who used to work in coal were not being hired in clean energy. And that wasn't an experience of, oh, well, I got the story wrong, better not do it. It was an experience of going out and reporting and learning and letting that learning experience inform the story you're telling. And that's what I try to do no matter what I'm covering, whatever the story is, whatever the beat or the job title might be.
Well, and that learning experience plus curiosity go hand in hand.
Totally. Yeah. And being open to being wrong, being open to realizing that your preconceived notions and the ideas that you went in with don't fit the existing reality.
Now, from reporting on 9/11 and the aftermath, to war zones, to shootings in the U.S., a pandemic, constant change, you know, every day is different. Mm-hmm. Have you figured out...
From your description, every day sounds like misery.
Right? Well, and
know,
it kind of...
Mass shootings, natural disasters, wars. Yeah.
Well, it leads into the question, like, have you figured out self-care as a journalist? I asked Sylvia Pagioli this, and she didn't have an answer.
Oh,
And I'm like, if Sylvia doesn't, I'm curious what your methodology is.
Well, there are two things I would say. One is about self-care, but the other is about resilience and optimism, which is that talking to people in those situations and seeing their faith in humanity and their insistence on helping people around them gives me faith in humanity and makes me feel more strongly than ever that I can't be pessimistic and just give up on humankind, because people who have so much less power and privilege than I do have not given up. And so what right do I have to say it's not worth it? You know, there's no hope. In terms of self-care, not to brag, but I think I have a very good work-life balance. I have two dogs, I have a husband, I have a garden, I do yoga. There's a lot that I do that is not work. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm pretty good at leaving my work at work. And I also have these side gigs that are really fun. The actor Alan Cumming and I have a cabaret show that we tour all over the place. I sing with a band called Pink Martini. I made a reality TV show for Netflix that I hosted called The Mole. And so life is more than journalism. Life is more than reporting the news. I really enjoy my job as a journalist, but I also enjoy that I get to do a lot of other things too.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get to those side hustles in a bit. Yeah, for sure. And I want to, curious about the hosting role specifically, mm-hmm. right? It's obviously a change when you're used to being just a reporter out in the field and becoming host of ATC in 2015. What habits do you have in your life that you think help you as a host? You know, say reading a lot or any other kinds of things.
One thing is just being good at juggling short, medium, and long-term projects. Because as a reporter, I had a much smaller number of things on my plate at any given time. And as a host, I'm juggling so many plates. Which leads into the other thing, which is that as a host, you are so dependent on a huge team of people. Any given day, on all things considered, my fingerprints might be on 10 different things, and maybe 3 of those have had my full, undivided, focused attention. And 3 of those I've paid a little bit of attention to in collaboration with others, and a handful of them I'm just jumping and trusting that there's a net there because the producers and editors and bookers have done all of the work, and I'm just the voice. As a reporter, that's not the case.
Right.
As a reporter, you can be more of a perfectionist. You are more of a solo operator, although not entirely. Obviously, there are editors and so on. But as a host of All Things Considered, I really had to adapt to trusting the team that I work with and knowing that it was okay for me not to give everything my undivided attention because it's just not humanly possible.
Right. Was that something that surprised you? Did you have any misconceptions going into the host role after being used to reporting for so long?
I think anyone who becomes a host has some control freak qualities within them. And I'm not as big a control freak as I might be, but I'm certainly more on that scale than not. So being able to let go and learning how to trust that other people would take care of it was a learning curve for me and continues to be after almost 10 years.
With being a voice throughout NPR, I feel like, and you share if you have the same perception as me, but in the past decade or so, I feel like there's been a shift where a journalist's voice has been more encouraged to not just be present, but incorporated into stories. And, you know, when I first started, it was more like, hey, you're a neutral facilitator. You don't have a personality. You don't have opinions. How have you observed this change? Do you think that's true?
I think you're absolutely right. When I started in journalism, there was a kind of view from nowhere, I say in air quotes, aspirational quality to who you are doesn't matter because you're just a journalist with a capital J. But the truth is there has never actually been a view from nowhere. There has been a view from the perspective of the sort of bland majority, which if we're just going to put our finger on it is straight, white, you know, Christian, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Yep.
And what I think we as journalists and as a country have realized in the last decade or so is that people of color have experience reporting on police violence that can be valuable. Women have experience that can inform their reporting on reproductive rights that is valuable. And so I tell a story in my book about in 2004, my college boyfriend and I wanted to get married, and it was in the early days of same-sex marriage, and I felt like I was somehow going to lose my journalism card if I went out and got married because it was a key part of the culture wars. And I realize, as time goes on, that my experience as a queer person actually helps my reporting and that it isn't something I have to stuff into a box or pretend doesn't exist. I've never been closeted as a journalist. I've been out my whole adult life. But I think that which makes us who we are actually makes us more interesting as journalists, and it's something we can bring to our reporting rather than trying to pretend that you and I are exactly the same and have the same experiences and will report stories in the same way. It's okay if we report stories in a different way. And that does not mean that we abandon the pursuit of objectivity and that we become partisans and that we become advocates. I still think as journalists, we need to strive to listen and hear all voices and represent different points of view accurately and in a nuanced way. But I think that doesn't mean leaving who we are at the door.
That was Ari Shapiro, host of NPR's All Things Considered, speaking with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski back in September when he visited Milwaukee to talk with voters ahead of the election. And did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? You can search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll visit the Urban Ecology Center's Bird Summer Camp. But first, we'll tell you about an art exhibit that explores how food and trust intersect. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Throughout the summer of 2023, fellows at UW-Milwaukee's Center for 20th Century Studies set out to interview 200 Milwaukeeans about their relationship with food and the food system. Their questions focused on food access, how people get food, and how people associate food and trust. Instead of going the traditional academic route and putting their findings in a research paper, UWM commissioned Milwaukee-based artists to turn their findings into an interactive exhibition that went on display at the 2024 Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market. Lake Effect's Sam Woods spoke with artists and researchers to learn more about the project and what they found.
It's Thursday evening, which, for me, usually means that I'm at the grocery store. You can tell what kind of week I'm having based on what's on my list. If it's been a smooth week, I have a full list built around 2 to 3 big meals that I want to make and eat throughout the next week, supplemented by what I already have at home. If it's been a rough week, I'm probably coming in with no list at all, and only a vague recollection of what I already have at home, which, to be honest, is maybe about 50% accurate at best. During these weeks that I'm not coming in with a plan, my grocery store experience is more emotional. Unlike the logical list-ticking of a good week, I'm visiting every aisle, looking up and down for inspiration in a store that I've probably been to dozens of times. And the ingredients I choose usually comes down to whether I want to head into the week comfortable or excited. Should I choose ingredients for comfort meals that I've had 1,000 times and know what to expect? Or maybe something that I haven't tried before that could be great, or could be disappointing. In the end, it comes down to, do I trust myself to make a new dish that I will enjoy? Do I trust that ingredients I haven't used before will behave the way I want them to in the kitchen? And do I trust that these ingredients have been handled properly, from farm and processing, to transit, to store, to my home? A new art exhibition at the Milwaukee Winters Farmers Market looks at the emotional decisions behind food, food access, and daily nourishment in our city. Named Food Journeys, the exhibition is an artistic interpretation stemming from 200 interviews of Milwaukeeans done throughout the summer of 2023. Jessica Thompson is a master's student studying sustainable peacebuilding at UWM and was one of the StoryCart fellows collecting interviews last summer for this project. I asked her about her excursions and what she and the other fellows asked people about their relationship with food and trust.
Yeah, so the questions that we asked, we started very simply, like, where do you most commonly gather your food? And the work behind that question was to understand how long it takes for people to get food, where they typically go. It was more of just like a question to kind of get people warmed up to talking to us, because the heart of the project was in trust, right?
I should back up and paint a picture. When Jessica and the other StoryCart fellows from the UW-Milwaukee Center for 21st Century Studies were going around asking people about their connections to the food system, they weren't doing so with a notebook in hand and ready to transcribe notes for an academic paper. No, they were going around in what they call the StoryCart, which is a mobile recording studio the team used to document these interviews. The goal was not to present themselves as academics or experts looking to study a problem, but as people, looking for connection and understanding for how their neighbors feel about food and the food system. Their summer-long travels took them to 50 locations in and around Milwaukee with whiteboards and voice recorders in tow, and they collected around 200 recorded interviews with questions ranging from, how do you get your food? To, what is a food you think about when you think about trust? And the stories they collected ran the gamut, from hard topics like transportation barriers to food access, to softer topics like favorite meals. Here's a clip from an interview at the Sherman Park grocery store with Jazz, who said she walks for hours, sometimes by choice, to find the food she likes.
Where do you often grocery shop?
Pick and Save.
Pick and Save? Is this your first time to Sherman Park Grocery?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Now, since you go to Pick and Save more often, can you tell me in as much detail as possible your journey to and from Pick and Save? Like, are you driving? Are you walking? Taking the bus? How far?
I'm walking and always carrying bags.
Okay. And how long is your walk?
Probably like 3 hours. But I don't, you know, it's like I used to run tracks when I was a little kid. So, walking.
So you're walking 3 hours to the grocery store?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you doing that multiple times a week?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow.
Every
ninth of the month?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Is there a specific reason that you go every ninth of the month?
Yes, for my WIC, for my son, he's 1 year old, and for my mom, because my mom stay across the street, and I do a little PCW work, and, you know.
Okay, so now I'm going to move away from this question, but let me delve deeper into this. So 3 hours walk, that's what's getting me. So is that your preference, or is there not a bus route around where you are?
It's the bus. I take the bus, but I like to walk a lot.
And there's, like, adequate sidewalks and stuff?
Yeah, make sure that I stay out the sun, shade, do a zigzag home.
When questions about food and trust came up, Jessica said usually people needed a moment to think about their connection between trust and food, oftentimes before turning to a favorite comfort meal. Here's a clip from an interview at the Bayview Outpost with Meg, who remembers a childhood dish her family called Slum Gully.
And when you think of trust, what is a taste or a recipe that comes to mind?
When I think of what?
Trust.
Trust? When I think of trust, the recipe that first comes to mind is a dish my mom made called Slum Gully. It was something that no matter what you could rely on to taste good and to make you feel good, no matter what, no matter what time of day, it could be 8 a.m. And it's the most simple thing I realized once I grew up, which is just beef, noodles, and tomatoes. And as a child, that brought us together. And when that meal was made, I trusted that it was going to be a good day.
As I mentioned, the goal was never to produce an academic paper about food access or Milwaukee's food system. Instead, the Storycart Fellows turned over their interviews to Milwaukee-based artists Katie Avila-Lockmiller and Adam White Osers to create an artistic interpretation of the interviews. As Katie explains, while a research paper is excellent for understanding the facts of a situation, art tends to be an easier access point for people to engage with the research.
Yeah, they could have just collected these stories, those themes, and said, you know, in this part of Milwaukee, people are traveling really far to their grocery store, this, you know, and like kind of broken into these box-in structures. But I think what our exhibit did was sort of kind of do an overview of like what people are saying, capturing these like kind of small moments, and making it more human.
And unlike a formal research paper, responding to an art exhibition is something anyone can do. You don't need formal training, you just need to have something to say. So Katie and Adam included an interactive portion of the exhibit that allowed visitors to react to the stories the Storycart Fellows collected, adding to their growing mosaic of Milwaukee's feelings towards food and food access.
We also had like a little interactive piece where we were like asked people to share their own stories, right? And it was interesting to see people's immediate reactions, being able to make their own artwork in reaction to our artwork in reaction to the stories, right? And so then that conversation keeps going.
I should note that Katie, Adam, and UWM did not create this exhibition alone. True School, an arts and hip-hop-based youth education nonprofit, contributed their own artistic interpretations of stories collected by the Storycart. The Milwaukee Food Council partnered on the project, as did Latinas Unidas en las Artes, or LUNA, a business co-founded by Avila Lockmiller that supports Latinx artists in Milwaukee. And the exhibition is hosted at The Table, which is also the site of the Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market. The inclusion of such a broad range of perspectives and talents means a lot to Adam White Osers. For one, he noted that because the exhibition is hosted in the same building as the farmers market, gives him a built-in excuse to revisit the exhibition regularly, to reflect on its themes while also being able to talk to vendors selling food there, further building trust between him and his food. That kind of built-in next step is something that is difficult to pull from a research paper, but comes more naturally with art.
Something a mentor told me long ago is the objective of contemporary art is to have us learn something new about the world or ourselves. So yeah, why art? Like, and that's like why we like watching plays and TV, because we can see ourselves. A report is facts and art is feeling. So that access point is important to me as an artist, that we can feel our way through something.
And for Jessica Thompson, one of the StoryCart fellows we met at the beginning who conducted interviews for the project, feeling your way through something can help point you in the direction of what needs to change. By viewing an exhibition like this, where the joys and the frustrations of food and food access live together, she hopes it helps people digest where our food system does and does not serve us, and what we can do to bring trust back to our food system.
I hope that people begin to question and think about their place in the food system, question the ways that they access food, or not necessarily question, but maybe think more deeply about. And I hope it like provokes a bigger conversation around the food system itself and how we can change the food system to better meet the needs of people in the city. Because I feel that the food system we have right now is failing a lot of people. And I think this exhibit is a way to provoke conversation around what's not working and what can we change? What do we have the power to change? And if we don't have the power to change what needs to be, how do we get to that point?
For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
That was Jessica Thompson, a StoryCart fellow and graduate student studying sustainable peacebuilding at UW-Milwaukee. Katie Avila-Lockmiller is the co-founder and creative director at Latinos Unidas de las Art. And Adam White Osers is a Milwaukee-based multimedia artist. They spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Still ahead, scientists help young birders learn about tracking bird populations. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every year, the Urban Ecology Center hosts a summer camp all about birds. One activity they teach campers is called bird banding. It's a way for scientists to track behavior and monitor the health of bird populations. It's done by safely catching, tagging, and measuring birds. This summer, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spent the day with scientists and campers to follow this up-close experience.
It's a dewy gray morning at Riverside Park, and a team of scientists is setting up a 12-foot-tall mesh net called a mist net. It's barely visible, blending in with the trees. Master bird bander Al Shirkow says birds don't see the net and fly right into it.
This is a lot like fishing. We put the nets where we think the birds are going to be, and we've had good luck at this spot.
Once a bird is caught in the net, researchers measure it and clamp a small bracelet with a unique ID number to the bird's ankle. That identification number helps scientists study a bird's migration pattern, its survival rate, and whether it's breeding. Brittany Peters with the Urban Ecology Center is setting up a bird banding station with all the tools a researcher needs to collect this data.
This is our banding table, where we have all of our data sheets, our pile guide, our tools, our bands, and yeah, this is our data collection site.
She says breeding bird surveys like the one today take place in the summer, and migration surveys happen in the fall and spring.
We capture everything we can. So the easier things are like the length of the wing, the weight. All of that data is super valuable. It tells us where birds are going, where they stop, what habitat they need when they stop there. All of that we can tell by looking at many birds. So it's pretty awesome.
I walk up a small hill with Peters as she checks on one of the missed nets for birds. She says for many people, seeing a bird up close for the first time can be a transformative experience.
Birds are such a fun and accessible way for kids to learn about the natural world. We can let them release the bird safely, and that is something that most kids never forget, especially kids that grow up in the city. We have some kiddos who have never seen Lake Michigan who live in this city, believe it or not.
And I'm about to find out just how meaningful bird banding can be for kids.
Hey, team, you can leave your backpacks right here, but grab your water bottles.
A group of third and fourth grade campers has just arrived back at the riverbank. Their teacher, Tori Baugh, explains today's activity.
What did we say we were doing today?
Banding.
Banding. So a band is kind of like a bracelet mixed with a license plate, so it's got a number on it.
Baugh
so
then introduces the students to Tim Bargo, the UEC's director of research and the leader of today's bird banding project.
Today is a beautiful day. It's not too windy, it's not rainy, it's not too hot, it's not too cold, and so we're lucky. All we need now is for birds to fly into the nets.
On one of the trips to visit a missed net, the moment everyone's been waiting for happened.
Oh my God, we actually
hey, Tori.
Got a bird.
We got a bird in the nets, I think, over there. Yeah, they caught a bird. I really want to see it.
As the excitement builds, a 9-year-old camper named Rose lets her mind wander and imagines all the possible birds in the net.
I'm hoping for at least a robin, because those are like some of the most, like, I see robins here a lot, so I'm guessing it's going to be a robin. But I mean, I'm hoping for maybe like a red-winged blackbird, but I don't really think that's gonna happen. If we caught a woodpecker, that would be like super cool.
Rose and the other campers have been learning about birds for a couple days now. As we approach the missed net, Amanda Tokuyama, UEC's field data manager, reminds students to keep their voices down as community scientist Brittany Peters carefully untangles the bird.
Okay, Brittany is still working on getting the bird out. So she needs to concentrate, so we're all gonna be quiet to not stress Brittany and not stress the bird. And we're not all gonna scream out what the bird is. We're gonna think about it in our head, okay?
Peters gently puts the bird in a small cotton bag. It kinda looks like a pillowcase. And we head back to the bird banding station while students make their initial observations.
It looks kind of like a raven, but I know it's not a raven.
Yeah, it's too small.
Yeah.
It's like mostly gray.
Maybe a rusty blackbird or something, like that's the name.
An eastern phoebe?
At the banding station, we look at a soft gray bird with a black cap on its head and rusty colored feathers under its tail. And Tokuyama identifies it.
Good job. So we've got a gray catbird.
The gray catbird is a common songbird in North America. Tokuyama holds the bird in what's called a bander's grip, with the bird's head secured between her middle and index fingers. Meanwhile, Peters records measurements and observations about the bird.
Okay, so I'm gonna read Brittany his band number now.
This is that special code.
Band number is 2211.
Peters then clamps a tiny bracelet with the unique ID number around the catbird's ankle. She also measures the bird's wing length and weight. The information she gathers today will be sent to the U.S. Geological Survey. So if this bird is caught again, its ID number will connect it to all the other data the scientists are gathering about the bird's health.
This bird has a brood patch. What does that tell us?
Maybe it's a female.
It might be a female. It's not going to tell you in your book, but it might tell us in our book.
After the team jots down all of this health data, it's time to let the bird fly free.
We're going to let it go. Bye-bye, Fluffy.
Before 9-year-old Rose ran off to check out the next Miss Net, I asked her what she thought about this bird banding experience.
It was super fun. I just loved learning about the bird. It was like, it wasn't like boring information. It was interesting. It's not like your teacher reading a book at school, just like blah, 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 this is about the animal. Yeah, like I had an actual opportunity to truly learn about a bird.
Now that Rose and her friends have seen one up close and even named it, they can't wait to learn more.
We just heard from young campers learning about bird banding from scientists at the Urban Ecology Center of Riverside Park this summer. That story was produced by Lake Effect's Excret Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. You can find all of this year's Chirp Chat conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can always download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.